The Bible reminds us that locust swarms have been a problem for farmers for millennia. In fact, they're still often described as plagues and continue to affect as much as 20% of the world's land. Last month, researchers discovered what starts locust swarms, and joining me now is Dr. Swedbert Ott, a Royal Society University Research Fellow at Cambridge University. I'm very pleased to welcome him to today's first underreported segment. Hello.
Hi there.
So what does a swarm of locusts look like?
Well, it must be truly formidable, but I actually have to disappoint you right from the start here. I've never been inside one. And so I only know the figures and the movies. And actually, I've been to Australia, just came back a week ago, and was hoping to see the Australian locusts there live in action, and we just missed them. So that was good news for the people affected there, but bad news for us. So
In your case, your research requires an awful thing to happen for you to understand it completely.
Well, not really, because we're approaching it in very controlled circumstances in the laboratory. So we're looking at the behavior of these animals under very tightly controlled circumstances. So we do not need to go out into the field, and so we do not have to wait for the disaster to happen for us to work on it and understand what's happening.
Now, normally locusts usually try to avoid each other. And then they suddenly gather at certain times. How long have researchers been trying to figure out what causes them to suddenly swarm?
Well, it goes back probably to the 1920s because what you should say is that these two ways of being a locust, they don't just behave differently. They also look very differently. And what that means that up until 1920, people hadn't actually realized that the swarming ones and the non-swarming ones are the same species. But once that was figured out, then the question arose as to how can one thing so different from another, you know, how can they transform into one another?
Now, the non-swarming ones look just like grasshoppers. Are they grasshoppers?
Well, they are indeed, yes. And I mean, locusts are just simply grasshoppers that have, they all belong to the same group of insects. They're all grasshoppers. And you find grasshoppers that are always benign and they're always, you know, going on about being grasshoppers. And you get locusts which are defined by their ability to, under certain circumstances, gather in these huge groups, and in many cases also transform their looks and their shape.
Well,
proportions.
They challenge each other normally, and then here suddenly they are cooperating.
Well, cooperating is actually probably the wrong word. I mean, normally they avoid each other, but when they do swarm, it's not a true social behavior as you would see it with bees or ants, where you have true collaboration and cooperation. In fact, being in a swarm is anything but a party. I mean, these animals turn cannibalistic also, because the swarms happen when there isn't enough to eat where they are, so they have to move on to some other place, but also they are constantly driven by hunger, and they turn quite nasty towards each other. So it's really quite the opposite of cooperation from that point of view.
And isn't that often a sign that a locust swarm might start?
That's absolutely right, yes.
Now, why would that be if they are acting out of hunger? Wouldn't the rain have encouraged the growth of crops?
That's exactly what's happening. But that's the prehistory to the swarm, you see. Normally these animals live in very barren regions, like semi-deserts and deserts.
Some of the poorest places in the world.
That's exactly true. And so they would normally eke out a living, you know, somewhere in the Sahara or sub-Sahara, and then occasionally you get rainfall, and this an unpredicted large amount of rain will come down, and the desert goes green. So you get a lot of vegetation, and so these animals can then multiply and breed very successfully, But of course, the desert being the desert, these good times don't last. And very soon, it gets very dry again, and combine that with a large number of locusts already in the region. So they have no other option than to actually overcome their tendency to run away from each other. And then they're being forced into what remains of the vegetation. And so they find themselves actually kind of funneled into these smaller and smaller dwindling patches of greenery. And then they are forced into contact with each other. And that's what triggers the change in behavior, and that triggers the swarming, and they move on. And of course, at the fringe of the desert, you have farmland often. And so this is why only when these outbreaks are that the locusts get in conflict with human, with agriculture. Normally, they just sit in the desert and don't bother anyone.
My guest is Dr. Swidbert Ott of the Royal Society University Research Fellow, in fact, at Cambridge University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, where does serotonin come into this whole story? How did you even think about serotonin as a cause of this swarming activity?
The starting point was simply that if the behavior changes, then something has to change in the brain. So you never get a behavioral change without something happening in the brain. So we knew that the root cause of the behavioral change has to be the brain. That's almost trivial, but it's worth emphasizing, I think. And then we also know that there's a whole class not chemically homogeneous class, but a whole battery or array of brain chemicals that modify how, these are called neuromodulators, so they modulate or modify how nerve cells talk to each other, how they communicate with each other, and they modify the properties of nerve cells. And it's these kinds of compounds that you have in your brain and that every animal has in its nervous system.
And some plants too, you say?
Say it again?
Don't even some plants have serotonin?
Well, plants do, yeah, but plants not having a brain, it doesn't act as a neuromodulator in plants. Mm-hmm. But yes, it serotonin as such is incredibly widespread. But we had no inkling initially whether it could be serotonin. So we just knew that probably it is one of these many kinds of neuromodulators that we know can change behavior by changing how your brain works. So we did a broad screen. This was actually done initially by a colleague of mine, Steve Rogers, who's here with me in Cambridge, and so we looked at changes in all kinds of neurochemicals as in the brains of animals that underwent the change from solitariousness to gregariousness, and the one thing there's many changes later on if you bring them together for long enough. But the one thing that stood out that really struck us was this spike, this rapid increase in serotonin specifically, which was unique. You didn't see that with the other compounds. So that was the first inkling that the answer may be in serotonin.
Well, in humans, serotonin helps to regulate anger, aggression, mood, sleep, appetite.
All sorts of stuff.
Metabolism, many antidepressants try to keep serotonin levels high. It has a positive effect on humans, but would this be considered a positive effect on from a locus point of view as well?
I think it's difficult to draw the parallels. I mean, it's good for a locus because it enables the animal to adapt to a change in its environment and switch to a different strategy and do the right thing. I'd be very cautious, I'd strongly argue against saying that a gregarious locust is a happy locust and a solitarious locust is a depressed locust.
Uh-huh.
That would do no justice to the locust and would probably also be quite an insult to any person who's depressive, you know. But at the very deep level, of course, there are similarities. In the sense that in both cases you have differences in how you as a person or as a locust respond to the environment and that the way you interact with your environment and with your fellow human beings or fellow locusts is contingent on a chemical, on an endogenous molecule in your brain, serotonin, which can profoundly alter this interaction with the world. So that is the parallel that is really interesting and very deep. But
well, desert locusts can consume the equivalent of their body mass each day. And that's not their only negative impact, is it? Don't they also have toxic droppings?
No, not really. Now, there's two aspects here which you may be alluding to. I mean, one is that they stuff themselves once they're normally when they're solitarists, they try and hide away, right? So they're very cryptic, and they try not to be seen by anyone. And in fact, when you go out and try and find them in between the outbreaks, you can't almost. It's almost impossible because they're so low densities and so well camouflaged. Once you're about in thousands and millions and billions, you can't hide away. So you're very conspicuous to predators, animals that want to eat you. So what the locusts then do is they actually switch their diet and they go out and eat toxic plants. And they stuff their guts with these toxic plants, so they become quite, well, I wouldn't say highly toxic to a bird, but at least very unpalatable and very disagreeable. But that's not something that really is a problem for humans at all. And in fact, people eat locusts as a supplement food in certain parts of the world.
Are locusts the same all over the world?
And
your study looked at African locusts, didn't it?
We did, yeah. And the ones we work on, they occur in northern Africa, all the way across from west to east, and then across the Arabian Peninsula and into India. And that's one species, and it's the most infamous, I suppose, and economically possibly the worst. But there's about 12 species, and they're not that close. They're all grasshoppers, but they're not that closely related to one another. And there's a species in Australia that I mentioned initially, which is quite different in size, and it's not closely related to the one we're working on. But it shows the same behavioral survival strategy to cope with these fluctuations in the environment.
Mm, so they swarm as well.
They swarm quite badly. And you had in the States, you had the Rocky Mountain locust, which you may be familiar with. But that was a huge problem in the 19th century. Huge problem until it more or less suddenly disappeared.
Would it have disappeared
because it's not actually extinct?
Would it have disappeared just because of human habitation, or have modern pesticides been a factor?
Say the last bit again. The line was:
would pesticides have been a factor in eliminating?
Now that was in the late 19th century. So it was a bit of a mystery what happened to them. They there was huge outbreaks very close to before they completely vanished, and it's thought that the outbreaks covered huge areas. In between these outbreaks, these animals withdraw into small pockets, which is called recession zones, small pockets of small regions, and there they're quite vulnerable to changes in the conditions. And it's thought that the plowing of native land, turning it into fields, may accidentally, without the farmers realizing, may have hit those zones where they hung out in between the outbreaks. And so that's thought to be the explanation why they're gone, and they're no longer around. I mean, they're no longer around, not only as a pest, but they're no longer around as a species, full stop. They're gone.
Well, would the world be better off if we got rid of locusts?
I don't know. You know,
do they have an ecologically positive impact?
I find it hard to answer that with any degree of certainty. I mean, I think if one were able to keep the swarming in check, that would certainly be a very beneficial thing.
Well, will your research help us to learn to do that?
It's certainly what is part of what we're trying to achieve. Yes.
And how would you do that? You can't just lower serotonin levels in a bunch of grasshoppers.
You're absolutely right, and you have already brought up the issue that serotonin isn't specific to locusts, even though the specific role is very specific in locusts. That as a molecule, we have it; all animals have it. So you can't just go around and get rid of serotonin by some non-specific chemical intervention that you spray over large parts of northern Africa. So the hope is that either we'd be able to, I mean, serotonin, in order to do anything in the brain, has to interact with very specific molecules, proteins called receptors. And now these receptors are very different between different animals, even though they're all receptors for serotonin. And so one hope is that maybe by finding drugs that specifically disable, target the receptor in serotonin, but don't work in humans and in other animals, that you can target it quite specifically. And the other route is to look what happens as an effect of serotonin in the locus brain. So serotonin will trigger a cascade of, it's like a domino effect. It's like a chain reaction of what happens within the nerve cells. And as serotonin reconfigures how they work, and the hope is that some of these, what we call downstream molecules, simply molecules that are further down in the chain of events, that some of them are very specific. Or indeed that some of the genes that are affected by serotonin in their expression levels are very specific, so that if we try to understand now how serotonin does what it does in a locus, we find some target which we can specifically attack and disable. That's the hope, and that's the strategy, I think.
And considering the kind of damage they do, the most recent desert locust plague was in Western Africa from 2003 to 2005. $2.5 billion worth of food was lost. My great thanks to Dr. Swedbert Ott, a Royal Society University Research Fellow at Cambridge University. Thanks for talking with us on today's Underreported.
Thank you very much.